So welcome, everybody, and thank you for hanging out for the last panel, usually called the losers panel. But there are no losers, except for myself. There are probably are no losers up here, and dare if I would call anybody that. These guys are amazing, and it's amazing that they've taken their time to come and share some insights on what is the most important issue of many issues that we have discussed at this conference, because if we can't make cancer drugs both affordable and accessible, all of the progress that we've reviewed over the past 2 days will go for nil. I managed to attend most of the meeting, better than I do most years, and I was richly rewarded for it, and I hope you were too. But what I was fascinated by was the fact that the pricing issue broke out on a few panels, right? Today it broke out on the exceptional responder panel, Peter, with one of your Sloan Kettering colleagues, David Solit, right, who talked, I think, convincingly and quite sincerely about the limitations on some of the work that he can do imposed by the cost of some of the drugs. Okay, it was pretty remarkable if you heard that and you were here to hear it. It was quite a remarkable thing. And there have been issues about pricing and pricings of, you know, immuno-oncology, and it's broken out on all the panels. So we don't even need to do this panel. We have accomplished what we set out to do a couple of years ago, which is to make this dialogue an important part of the meeting. But since all of you may not have been here since the beginning, I'm just going to open this before I ask the panelists to just introduce themselves quickly and make a couple of opening comments, and then we'll get down to the discussion. We'll have plenty of time to involve the audience. So please get up and shout. If you need a mic runner, I'm sure we can get you one. We'll get into this dialogue. But I just want to start off with just a little bit of history, okay? Just so you get a history a couple of years before we started this at this panel. This meeting has been running for, Jeff, what is it, 28 years? Something like that? 28 years.
Was it always called Cancer Progress?
It was always called Cancer Progress, which was actually an oxymoron, as you know.
Because it was aspirational.
Right. No. It was highly aspirational. Just a couple of time points to set this. So ipilimumab was approved in March 2011. The treatment cost for the approved dose as a monotherapy was $120,000 per course. There were notable other approvals that year, and if there were many of them, one was Sutent, about $50,000 annual cost. Zelcori, about $115,000 annual cost. Zelboraf, about $207,000 annual cost. Zytiga, about $60,000 annual cost. And I know there's vast differences in the cost per patient and the patient population, so if you're all writing that down, you can save that. This is just directional, all right? In that same year, in 2011, researchers from the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center in Washington presented a study that determined that a cancer diagnosis could be considered a risk factor for personal bankruptcy. In other words, of the many possible reasons an individual may have to file for personal bankruptcy, receiving a cancer diagnosis could certainly qualify as one of them, in fact, a major one of them. The research team found that bankruptcy rates were almost twice as high among cancer patients 1 year after their diagnosis compared to the general population. On top of that, the median time to bankruptcy was just 2.5 years after diagnosis. One of the conclusions reached by the research team was that oncologists really needed to acknowledge and address the impact of the cost of cancer care on their patients on an individual basis. 2 years later, in 2013, a pair of researchers from Duke proposed a term which you've all heard now. In fact, if you pop it into Google today, you will get 33 million hits for the term financial toxicity, okay? Hmm. And you could check it. It probably grew since I did it 2 days ago. The quote was, out-of-pocket expenses might have such an impact on the cancer experience as to warrant a new term, financial toxicity. Out-of-pocket expenses related to treatment are akin to physical toxicity in that cost can diminish quality of life, okay? Very interesting. In 2012, 12 NMEs were approved and launched for oncology indications. I'm not going to belabor the names of all of these, and I probably can't pronounce most of them, But the average monthly cost of these therapies was $9,304. Okay, I have a reference for all of this, so I'm not making it up. So that was 2012, and in 2013, I met the fine gentleman to my left and to your right, right of me, Peter Bach, because he was invited to give a keynote talk at this meeting. Okay, this marked the first time the topic of cost and affordability of cancer drugs was part of the agenda for the Cancer Progress meeting. Okay, because for all the years of its history, it had been focused on scientific and clinical progress being made against cancer. Peter made a big hit that year. I'm not sure he made everybody happy, but he certainly had everyone's attention. I remember the Q&A. We eventually had a break. It just went on and on and on. It was pretty remarkable. So we decided to, we had a good thing going, and we said, let's convene a panel discussion and bring Peter back with a few important people in the field. And we did that beginning in 2014. Okay. At the time of that discussion, Keytruda and Opdivo were still not approved, and pricing was only speculative. This was only a couple of years ago in March, in 2014. Keytruda and Opdivo were approved in the fall of 2014, first Keytruda in October and Opdivo in December, priced at approximately $150K per year and $143K per year, respectively. We talked about the issues. We talked about pricing. We said it wasn't sustainable. We said it couldn't keep happening. And we had another panel discussion. All right. This time, Peter was back. He's our veteran here. He gets a frequent flyer award for being kind enough to join us every year. He was accompanied by some other experts, Lee Newcomer from UnitedHealthcare, Len Saltz, one of Peter's colleagues at, no, he wasn't a colleague, although you know him well, at Weill Cornell. And that was fun, too. Okay. That was a whole bunch of fun. All right. But we still didn't have combos approved. We had the first combos approved, again, in fall of that year. Fall is the time of year when payers in this field start to say, oh, my God, okay? So the first combo approved was Yervoy-Opdivo, cost of the combo cocktail about $256,000 a year discounted off the cost of the two components. We then had another discussion in March of 2016. Peter was here. Roy was here, okay? We brought Wall Street in. We brought Adam Furstein from the street, okay? We brought Rob Glassman. Is Rob still here? Today, Rob was here at this panel last year. He's a banker and an oncologist. We had Mike Colage from who was then at Aetna, has moved on, I think, to Flatiron. But you know, but again, we had quite a panel. All right, and now let's get to where we are. So we've had a few years of history. Last year at the panel, okay, Peter opined that the current model, you know what I'm going to say, reminded him of the last call at the buffet. Okay, as all you eat buffet is the biopharma companies grab whatever they can in the form of ultra-high prices prior to the top falling down or the bottom falling out, all right? Here's what's happening since Peter said that, okay? By the way, does anyone here know, because I heard 82 estimates, there must be a real number for the number of cancer clinical trials going on. I heard 800, I heard 1,000, I've heard 500. The best estimate I have, based on what I hear here, is about 1,000 trials. About half of them are IO, novel IO-IO combinations, about half of them. So assume there's 500 trials out there, all right? Most of them are early. That's probably good because we have a little bit of time to figure it out. Don't have to figure it out today. But we can't be sitting here another 3 or 4 years and keep doing this, okay? There's an urgency to this. KITE program, all right, is expected to be approved in 2017, all right? We don't know what the pricing is going to be, but the analysts are saying this is a $2 billion product. This is $2 billion. Patient population is a segment of the lymphoma patient population. It's pretty damn small. Do the math, okay? It's not going to be inexpensive, all right? And there's going to be fast followers behind, all right? And there's little indication, as we've talked about on this panel before, from the history of oncology drugs, that any price competition is going to really materialize, right? Maybe we'll see it, okay? But so far we haven't. And then there's a lot of companies, finally, and maybe we'll get to discuss this, right, that are pursuing neoantigens. We've heard a lot about neoantigens, fully individualized, not only highly personalized, but fully individualized cocktails delivered to the patient for that patient's exquisitely unique tumor. But they're not off-the-shelf products. How are we going to price them? At this rate, based on what we're talking about, the prices of these will be something that we'll certainly we'll be taking notice of. Okay, so again, we have a few rustles going on about that buffet. Okay, this year I noticed before giving a talk that CVS, the PBM, put Xtandi, prostate cancer drug, on their exclusion list. Okay, so cancer drugs have started to pop up in exclusion lists. Roger probably knows a few more recent examples, but there weren't. So here's the purpose of the panel. How much progress are we making and have we made in making better cancer therapies? A lot. We don't have to have that. We had that for 2 days here. How much progress are we making about making them more affordable and accessible while preserving incentives for the continuous innovation necessary to ensure we continue to make progress? And next year, we're not talking about the pricing so much. We're talking about the progress, right? It's going to be really, really interesting if we can get that. Here's the buzzkill, and here's the problem. All of the solutions offered to date, in my opinion, suffer from one or more of the following sort of limitations. They involve at least some complexity. That's okay, we're in cancer. It's a pretty complex disease. They'll likely favor one group of stakeholders at the expense of other groups of stakeholders. That certainly is a problem, okay, but we have to acknowledge it. They may have the potential to create perverse incentives, all right, for using either less efficacious and or more expensive treatments. Certainly we hope not, but the incentives are clearly there or could be there. Can be perceived as some type of rationing, not something we easily cotton to in the United States. And many of the models are still experimental. I mean, as Roy can talk, there are experimental models, and we're just starting to perhaps get some validation that they're starting to work, all right? So I introduced the panel now at this. I just called it a Laurel and Hardy moment, right? It's a fine mess. It's a fine mess. It's usually the quote is, it's a fine mess you got me into. It's a fine mess we got all into, all right? So I don't want to debate how we got into the mess unless you think it points a way to get out of it, all right? Otherwise, I'd like to just focus on how we move forward and make sure that the great progress that we've discussed, this is the most optimistic meeting lately, okay? Years ago, it was a downer to attend this meeting. It's an optimistic meeting. We really are making progress. Let's not screw it up, okay? So that's my introduction, and I'll let the panelists go in either order they like. Whoever feels pushy today can introduce themselves, maybe just give a two-minute level set about your views on this, and then we'll get into the discussion. Thanks. And by the way, their bios are all in your book, and they're really long and really impressive, so just read them if you don't know the people up here. Okay.
Peter's not being pushy. We're just doing this in order.
We're doing it alphabetically.
Okay.
Oh, no, Rogers, maybe not. Okay. So I'm Peter Bach. Ed's already mentioned some of my work. I'm a physician at Memorial Sloan Kettering, and actually Len Saltz is a colleague of mine. He's at both Cornell and Sloan Kettering, as am I, actually. It's true, I referred to the pricing environment as a buffet that was about to close. I think it's more a buffet where all that's left is the gluten-free items. the environment is right now extremely intriguing because of the dynamics Ed has mentioned, that there is enormous optimism fueled by appropriate science around a lot of approaches, including immunotherapy. The last number I saw, by the way, is 830 registered trials in clinicaltrials.gov just in the IO space, 500 of which are in 2-3. In phase 2 or 3. Oh, okay. So very robust pipeline, to say the least. Median of 1.8 endpoints, 3 subgroups. I mean, a lot of experimentation going on. But I've become intrigued by this because there's a couple of, I think, facts, although we currently live in a world where everyone gets their own facts, but the facts that I've seen make you think that there's a challenge, there's a long-term challenge. And the facts are that any metric you use to evaluate the prices of pharmaceuticals suggests that you have declining incremental value per unit of price increase. So if you look at the prices of drugs today compared to 50 years ago when Medicare launched, and we track this on our website, cancer drugs cost about 100 times as much as they did 50 years ago, adjusted for inflation. If you look at kind of incrementally for an additional dollar spent on a cancer drug, what does it yield in terms of health gains? Even though we're very excited about what's going on in terms of science, the incremental yield has also declined over the last 20 years by about 80%. So a dollar spent on a cancer therapy today buys about one-fifth as many days of life, if you will, as it did 20 years ago, again, adjusted for inflation. But you have this ballooning expense the last 3 years, and it'll be the last 4 years. The largest inflationary bucket in healthcare has been in drugs. It's driven by specialty, branded specialty drugs, even though those are for a minority of patients. That's where all the spending is. The consequences for payers is that premiums rise, and even while they're pulling back kind of the extent of insurance coverage, and we're obviously about to go right through another debate about what insurance coverage looks like now with ACA kind of being relooked at, but you see both premiums rise and insurance being stripped away, and you see clear evidence of access problems. So if we didn't have, if we could take any one of those things off the list, I think we could be like, we're fine. Like, we love science, we have access, insurers are able to cover people in an affordable way, we're spending a lot, but we got the money. I think it would all be fine. But the problem is, we don't. We have all of those things. And so a recent analysis in Health Affairs showed that compared to 9 other Western countries, the penetration of cancer drugs into the populations of cancer is the lowest in the U.S. of any of its Western kind of European comparator countries. So we actually, even though we pay more for drugs, the number of people with cancer getting these treatments falls behind every one of these other countries. And that's true even in Germany, where the formulary overlap is near complete. So, you can't sort of be satisfied when, for example, patients in Medicare who don't have the subsidy to pay their out-of-pocket average 5 months until they get their first Gleevec fill after diagnosed with CML. That's inconceivable. If they have the subsidy, by the way, it's about 2 months. So it's all about money, right? That actually means the poor get the drug before the near poor, which is an inversion of the usual pattern, but nevertheless. So those are the things that make me think we need a completely different approach, and I'm sure we're going to talk about it. Mm-hmm. But I've become convinced by data that competition actually fails to lower branded prices effectively, and that we need to create an innovation environment where drugs that work better get higher rewards, and that companies that make better drugs get bigger premiums for that. And that's hence the idea of value-based pricing, which I'm sure we're going to come back to, the idea of using a value framework based on drugs to solve for price and to have insurance structures kind of work around those so that appropriately priced drugs have appropriate coverage and access to. So I'm sure we'll come back to it, but that's sort of where I've been focusing.
Thank you, Peter. Roy?
So my name is Ray Beveridge. I'm a medical oncologist by training. I practiced for 20 years outside of Washington, D.C. I was the chief medical officer for U.S. Oncology for a number of years, and then worked at McKesson. I changed jobs and became the chief medical officer for a large insurance company. And the perspective that I've had in this new role for the past 4 to 5 years is that we all think oncology is incredibly important. It is. But in the grand schema of things, as people look across the entire book of business, it's a important problem, but it's not the most important problem. Chronic diseases for our country in terms of societal costs are by far the most important cost driver. And when policymakers are looking at drug spend versus oncology spend versus social spend, they're going to gravitate to those, larger costs where there are, significant savings. Now, if you put this in the framework of what CMS has been told to do via Congress, which is MACRA. So we're all moving into a value world. This value world is going to force the entities that are taking risk, and those will be the Johns Hopkins. It'll be any of the large provider groups that are taking risk to sit and take and get a bucket of money and have groups of physicians figure out how this bucket of money is going to be spent, in effect. And so I think, getting back, Peter, to your point of How are these choices going to be made? It's going to be a very complex set of circumstances in the next number of years. And people will start looking at the relative value of expensive drugs in terms of how effective they are, not just within oncology, but also compared to the costs in rheumatology or the costs in diabetes, the cost in, you know, back surgery, things like this. So I would urge people to stop thinking about this in complete isolation, because if you do, that may not work out well for all of our patients.
Thanks, Rory.
Well, good afternoon. I'm Scott Shortenhouse from Lilly Oncology. I was joking with Ed earlier that not only am I the only industry rep up here with on this panel on the value of cancer drugs, I'm the only industry rep in the history of this panel on the value of cancer drugs. And it reminds me of the Far Side cartoon. I don't know if you've seen it, but two deer are in the woods, and one deer looks down at his chest, and he's got a big circle with a bullseye painted right on him. And the other one looks at him and says, "That's a heck of a birthmark, Hal." And so I kind of feel a little bit like I'm the deer with the bullseye on my chest. But in all seriousness, you probably all have a preconceived notion about the industry before I even open my mouth. And that's okay. And we all are familiar with the narrative that tends to underemphasize some of the innovation that the industry brings to patients and tends to overemphasize some of the profitability. And we'll have a discussion on that today, and I'm looking forward to it. But the reason I'm starting here is just to not only put the moose on the table, so to speak, but also to say that, our messaging matters in the value debate, and our assumptions color our mindset, which in turn will inform the solutions that we provide to patients that need help managing their disease and managing the costs associated with that disease. And so as we talk about this today, I'd like to just set the table with two points. One is to push back on this narrative just a bit. And then the second is to talk about who defines value. Okay? So a little bit on the industry. I mean, you all know that 1.7 million Americans will be diagnosed with cancer this year, second leading cause of death. And so the need to innovate is great. But we have made great progress. We've cut cancer deaths by 25% over the last two decades. And many cancers that were death sentences a few decades ago, like testicular cancer or CML, are now more manageable chronic diseases, which opens itself up to a whole different set of issues when it comes to the payer. But my point is that we've been innovating, and the opportunity with the advent of IOs, with the advent of genomic sequencing, we are really on the precipice of an exciting time in terms of cancer care delivery. I'm a policy guy, so sitting through this scientific conference, I have to say that my mind's been blown a little bit. I can't say I've been following every single presentation. That one on the cancer viruses got a little dicey, a little quick, though some of those slides I couldn't really follow. But for the most part, I was able to follow what we've been talking about. And as Ed said, it's been a very optimistic conference. Because as the guy from GSK said yesterday, we could see some of these cancers, some of the more deadly forms of cancer like lung cancer or breast cancer be able to be controlled or even cured in our lifetime, which is an incredibly exciting prospect. All because we can we understand the biology better than we did 10 years ago, 20 years ago. Dr. Rudin yesterday was saying that lung cancer is not just one disease, but it's the heterogeneity of diseases with all the different mutations. So we are understanding cancer better and targeting them more effectively. As to our profitability, it probably doesn't. A stat you probably don't know is that we are 36th in the country in terms of all of industries when it comes to return on equity. When we're behind such industries like, footwear or auto parts, and so that means that the business of creating life-saving, life-extending drugs is also less profitable than creating spark plugs or perhaps tennis shoes, okay? And I'm not going to go into all of the details on how risky and how expensive it is to bring a drug to market, but I will talk about one statistic today, which is that in all of cancer care, drug spend is 20%. 20 cents out of every dollar spent in cancer care today is on drugs. And according to several different studies, that ratio is going to stay steady over the next 10 years. So I want you to keep that in mind. And the reason I just raised this today is if we can get past the preconceived notion on the industry a little bit to get in past this narrative and provide a little context to get into some real solutions that matter to patients, that's important. Final thing I'll say is on definition of value. I was very excited that Ed titled this session, Valuing the Value of Innovation.
Jeff did.
What?
Jeff did.
Well, thank you, Jeff. Not valuing the cost of innovation or valuing the price of innovation, right? Because price and value are two different things. And now we're adding in the dimension of benefit and risk of the therapy for the patient, which is what the patient cares about. Now, who gets to define value? Is it Dr. Beveridge from the payer perspective? Is it Dr. Bach from a provider perspective? Is it Eli Lilly from an innovator perspective? Is it from the perspective of a patient like my dad who was a cancer patient last year? I think all of these are very valid questions. I think there are different answers, but they're equally valid. From my perspective, I'm most interested in defining this from the patient perspective and making sure that at the point of care, the patient has all the information that they need to make a good decision and to amplify the patient voice in the value debate, really. And one last thing on financial toxicity, since Ed brought it up. You know, we understand and appreciate the financial hardship that cancer care brings onto patients that have been diagnosed. And we understand it, and we don't think that any patient should go bankrupt for their cancer care. But there is something that's even harder than financial toxicity, which is limited options in terms of drugs, which is poor patient outcomes in terms of overall survival. And I think it's important within the debate to balance the push for new innovation with all the promise we've heard today with patient access, because they're two very valid and equal and important things. My dad last year died before we could get him treatment. But if he had gotten that far, I would have been thankful as his son to understand and appreciate all of the different options that we had. He had gallbladder cancer at the time. And to make a decision that was in the best interest of him, regardless of the financial strain on our family, which of course he would have considered. So, with that, I'm looking forward to a robust debate on this very esteemed panel, and I'll hand it over to Roger.
Thank you, Scott. Roger?
My name's Roger Longman. I'm with a company called Real Endpoints, and just to answer the question that Scott asked, who gets to define value? Frankly, we get to define value. That is my company, because that's what we do.
I didn't know this.
Well, Scott, one of the reasons that Lilly's stock price isn't as high as it should be is that you're not a client.
Fair enough. I'll tell my CEO.
You should. I've told him. In any event, what we do is we look at drugs and regimens and compare them head-to-head. In a very transparent qualitative system, and we work with pharmaceutical companies and payers on these systems. And actually, we work with Peter, who's a drug advocate, uses some of our technology and some of our research. So I guess I would like to take a slightly different point of view and suggest where I think we may be headed in terms of, I guess, pricing or net pricing. And I'd like to review first that when, I guess it was right, roughly 2014, when I think the first cannonball hit the pharmaceutical industry, and that was HCV. When Sovaldi was introduced, but when AbbVie's drug Viekirapak was introduced,
yep.
And for the first time we saw in a specialty area, for the first significant time we saw in a specialty area, real price competition brought on by a single actor, and that actor was Express Scripts. Basically what they did was they said, we are willing to go with an inferior drug for our benefit, for our customers, which was AbbVie's Viekirapak, versus Gilead's second-generation Harvoni. And immediately, the net price of that drug dropped and very quickly hit roughly 55-60%. And I just saw, this is from, so Harvoni was $85,000, $86,000, something like that. I just saw that the VA is now paying $37,000 for Harvoni. So this has really been a remarkable drop. But I will point out that it was because there was one single actor who was able to drive this, a guy with lots and lots of market power. The second shoe dropped with the launch of the PCSK9s, remarkable drugs, lipid-lowering agents, which have been marketplace failures, which very, very few people expected. I will say that we were one of the few who did expect this, largely because the competition was there, but also because payers, no longer PBMs, but actually insurance companies, were prepared for the launch of this and set up prior authorization and other kind of utilization management tools to dramatically limit the use of these drugs. So just got off the phone with one of our users, very big national health plan. They told me that they were now at 2% of their originally projected prescriptions. In fact, actually, Roy's colleague, William Fleming, told me that, I can't even remember what he had said, was his undercount of what the PCSK9s were going to be at for Humana, but it was huge. Mm-hmm. He was very embarrassed about it. He said, we had no idea we could that it would be that low. However, but again, what we've got here is a group with market power, that is to say, payers, not PBMs in this case, but really insurance companies who are able to set up these rules. We've now got two other areas which I think, you know, to talk about, or to use Peter's metaphor of the buffet. Certainly, oncology has been a buffet. But the other one that has been a buffet that people have run into and they kind of overlap is orphan drugs. So if you think about orphan drugs, many companies have jumped into the orphan space. The prices have been extraordinary. However, we have also just seen two other signal events happen. One was the launch of Exondys 51 from Sarepta. And the second has been the launch of Biogen's Spinraza. What was extraordinary about these two events is that Exondys came out with very, very limited efficacy data, and you suddenly saw plans do something that we had never seen before, which was, we're not covering it. That hadn't really ever happened, at least in a big way, where you had national payers saying this. And on the regional side, our regional users are also interested in how do I limit the use of these drugs. Next, Spinraza comes out. Spinraza comes out with excellent data in a segment of the population and no data in others. And what have you seen? A bunch of payers have come together and said, not come together, I guess that would be collusion, but in any event, they've made their own decisions.
They would never do that.
And what you see is people significantly limiting the use of this drug, which leads us to oncology. Is it likely that oncology is going to be able to resist the same kind of pressure? Well, possibly. Neither payers nor PBMs have much influence, frankly, over oncology drugs. Most payers abide by compendia when they're making decisions about oncology drugs. They don't really have that influence there. On the other hand, what we are seeing is our old friends, you remember back from the HCV days, the PBMs, looking and saying, well, you know what, our margins are no longer quite what they were a couple of years ago. We're not making as much money. We need to move into other areas. The other area we're going to move into is what is called medical benefit drugs. Mm-hmm. Medical benefit drugs are the kind of drugs you don't get at a pharmacy. And most oncology drugs are medical benefit drugs. So what do you think the strategy of ESI and CVS and Optum is? Well, one of them is, how do we get into this game? How do we get into the medical benefit drugs on which we can get rebates and so on and so forth and make money? They're moving in this direction. We can go into details of how they're doing that. But I guess I would suggest to you that it is very difficult for me to see this trend starting with HCV and moving into orphans, not actually taking the next step and moving into oncology. So with that, I will stop.
Okay. Well, thank you to everybody. And let me just level set after all those spectacular opening comments. Try to figure out how we can, in half an hour or so, make some progress. First of all, I want to say to Scott, welcome, and I was going to congratulate you for your bravery, but frankly, it's actually Peter who was the brave guy initially, because he stepped in front of an audience which was mainly industry types, has been for many years, and many of the friendly industry types are the people you're looking at out there.
Fantastic.
Okay, so you can be, you're a fairly large guy.
He's got the target on.
You don't look like you need a bodyguard, but, we'll go from there. I don't think you need to feel that way, and I think the point is, we said this years ago, we called it a trialogue. We want to make it, something that we make progress. We don't want this to break down. This discussion does not need to break down into an issue that starts to resemble the national political scene. Okay, we will never get anything done. All right, that gives me a segue. Okay, and I didn't actually send this question in advance, but it's a floater. But some of the things, Roger, that you're saying. On some of the things I've heard everybody say, sort of suggest to me that we can't avoid at least touching on an actor we haven't talked about here, which is the government, which is legislation, which is that reality. Maybe we ought to start there. Scott, you're the director of advocacy for Lilly, so I'm sure you'll have some thoughts here. I don't want to spend a lot of time there, and the reason I want to spend a lot of time is because when I get asked to speak on this issue, and I'm only 1/50th as qualified as anybody here, so I'll always defer. But I always say I'm not sure legislation is the biggest threat, okay? And I think it's because of what I've learned from hearing Roger and the fact that the payer base is so powerful now and consolidated. And to his point, it really started happening in a big way in 2014, where they started leveraging that battering ram against a couple of companies in the HCV space and said, wow, this is cool, we can do this, okay? And so I think it's those loaded up payers with the buckshot, Scott, to your point, aiming at the target that are probably a bigger threat. But within that context, how do you see, let's just start there, because I have to be on a panel of this on Thursday and I have no idea what to say. So I'm going to, you can educate me a little bit. What do you think is going to happen? It'll all be wrong and it's fine. We won't review that. Anybody wants to jump in, go ahead. Peter?
See, federal government?
Yeah,
questions?
Federal government, state government.
Well, the signals out of Washington of direction are so clear that we couldn't possibly be wrong on these predictions. I think you're right to some extent that, it's mostly a question of how much government will sort of get out of the way of the private sector in terms of action. And I do think some directionality from the Republicans is sort of clear, which is, a lot of this language is, it's put in polite terms, but it's really about kind of backing off of structures and requirements in the private insurance market. A wolf in sheep's clothing guised as, freedom of choice or whatever or something. People, I think Paul Ryan said something, people should be able to buy the insurance that they need. Misunderstanding that insurance is for the thing you don't know is coming, not the thing you do. But never mind that, it seems like the general direction is to sort of ease up, right? And so a lot of these environments, like in oncology, insurance insurers to get registered in states have had to require include every cancer drug in their coverage policy in 76, covering about 76% of the U.S. population, most of the states. And, you know, to the extent that this federal pullback and the pullback on the exchanges also probably extends into state regs, that's a hard call to make. States generally are much more circumspect. But to the extent that it does, and we have more and more Republican governors now, that does free up these very big actors to be quite brutal in the pricing market and the formulary market in terms of tiering. And to the extent that, you know, if you think about, and this is always interesting to me, the cap the copay kind of thing, protect the patients, you know, is very much a notion of the left now, which isn't actually what you'd predict, but it is how it's kind of the sides have lined up. To the extent that that isn't the message of the day, you know, one of the key tools that the private payer market has is not the non-coverage of Sarepta. It's the tiering and co-insurance and essentially making things, well, of course it's on formulary. You just have to pay 100% of the price, but we can cover it. And by the way, you don't even get our negotiated price, right? You get, like, basically full whack, detail. Right?
Right.
Yeah, or at least, yeah, close, right? So I think it's, you know, I think the read is that, you know, less federalist intervention into state regulation of private insurance, that's big.
Mm-hmm.
On the federal Medicare side, you know, that's it. Nobody has any idea, I think, where we're headed. I certainly wouldn't want
to. Well, that's not helpful to me for tomorrow, but thank you. That's okay.
And then, you know, on Medicaid.
It's going to be a really short panel.
Well, I think the other issue is Medicaid isn't a big driver of revenue in most pharma spaces. There's a few branded specialty spaces which are big drivers. Oncology, it's de minimis. About 5% of oncology revenues come from the Medicaid programs. But if you even believe half of the very short bill they introduced, it's really about essentially undoing the Medicaid program. And so that is a harbinger of decreased spending. I mean, just less coverage and decreased spending. Not a big threat, like I said, in oncology. A very big threat in some other areas in healthcare, though.
So, Scott, what do you think? What do you think on the policy side?
So on the policy side, you know, as Dr. Bach said, it's really hard to figure out where they're going to go. The two provisions that the administration have been vocal on are importation, right, and allowing negotiation in Part D. I don't know. First of all, they've been able to do importation now since early 2000, 2001. If the secretary could say that it's safe and effective, and they've not been able to do that. So they don't need any new legislation to do that unless they want to direct the secretary to do that. The second is on negotiation of Part D, I have no idea. I think that the current HHS secretary is against that. I'm not sure where the government's going to go in that. What I do think is going to happen, though, is I think you're going to see the oncology care model and MACRA start to move the cancer care in the doctor's in the physician's office, and also I think you're going to see some drug companies as well move toward into more of a value type space, right? There's a lot of companies, and Lilly's one of them, that are entering into more and more value based contracts. We've got one or two with you, I think, not in cancer yet. We're doing it more with our diabetes drugs or our blood thinner drugs, which are easier to honestly measure the outcomes as opposed to cancer, which is much more complicated for reasons I won't get into. But all that to say, you know, we've been thinking about this, especially in the cancer space, whether it's pricing by indication or value-based contracts, for a while now. And I think you'll continue to see this. We're going to need some government help in terms of some of the regulations that are there, whether it's anti-kickback, best price, ASP. But I think you'll see the government start to hopefully be more and more conducive to these type of arrangements. And I think through, not to use too many words, but OCM and MACRA, through some of these alternative payment models, you'll start to see more and more of a look at the overall cost of care within cancer care.
So the largest insurer in the United States is CMS. And one thing that's absolutely clear to me is that MACRA is not going to be substantially affected in the new administration. Remember, it was passed by both sides of the aisle with overwhelming majorities, which is which was unusual at the time it was passed. Mm-hmm. So I would challenge folks here to think and not forget that the path that CMS has started going down in terms of value and assigning risk is going to continue, and if you look at the timetable, is going to accelerate.
I agree.
So and so, you know, I do urge people in the room, when you think about insurance, to think about different types of insurance. So think of Medicare as a book of business. If you're thinking then about the commercial insurance, most of which we in this room have, remember that the commercial insurers generally are getting about a 2% margin from your employer. And your employer sits and spends a lot of time with your Blue Cross or whatever plan that you've got figuring out benefits. And so it's not, you know, a group of people in Hartford or in Minneapolis who are making all these decisions. It's a very complicated process whereby what you are willing to pay from your paycheck through your employer is largely determining the tiering and the decisions that you've just heard Roger talk about, which I thought was a really great discussion in terms of the non-oncology, you know, drug spend in the last couple of years.
So Roy, Scott said we don't have outcomes-based models, or Lilly doesn't yet, and I would say Lilly's not unusual in that regard, in cancer. And Scott also said, and I wrote it down, and Scott, I'm only going to pull your leg on this because it's like, you know, somebody else who's in, it's a guy in the White House said healthcare is complicated, right? So, you know.
He said nobody knew healthcare.
It could be so complicated, right? Wow. But you know, Scott, you just said that, you know, cancer is complicated, and obviously it is for a variety of reasons. But what complicates the outcomes situation there? And I'm going to go to Roy only because, you know, you've got some experience. I've read some of your writings on this issue and in the field. And so where are we? Where is the state of the art right now in terms of moving this field to outcomes?
You know, to Roger's point earlier, I am going to answer your question. Mm-hmm. But the reason that the PCSK9s didn't really take off was not so much that the payers, you know, did a Heisman and, you know, kind of blocked things. It's because the cardiologists came up and were pretty clear about what they felt were appropriate outcomes. And there was a lot of support around the country in terms of these are standards by which we all should abide by. I will tell you that Humana has no interest in coming up with oncology standards that we want to have just for our patients. And I can, you know, tell you that the other payers don't want to do the same thing either. I'll tell you that as a provider, you know, if I'm seeing patients, I don't want to have 15 different metrics in terms of outcomes. And so, you know, one of the things that, you know, we on the payer side keep pushing for, and the cardiologists are way ahead of us, by the way, folks, in oncology, give us some standards. Give us some outcomes that we have the ability to measure. And the reason this becomes important is if you believe that there are two essential things that a payer should be looking at, one, which is the cost, which everyone is attentive to, but if you believe the other part is quality, right, which is really important, which you can talk about this in terms of drug costs also, but if you no longer have that quality metric on any decision, then you have a race to the bottom, because then everything then is determined on what's the cost. So what we're advocating across the country is specialty societies and others have got to come up with standards for not just the costs, but for the quality of the product or the quality of the physician. Because if we don't, we're going to have a race to the bottom because it's just going to be determined by cost.
Can industry innovate there?
Ed, can
and that's
I
a
just,
question. Yeah, and sure, Roger, but really? Let me let you get back there. But also I want to keep that question there, and maybe, Roger, you can put it into your remarks because this is some of what you do. Can the industry innovate, you know, in some of these outcome measures and push that forward? Go ahead, Roger.
Sure. One, everything that Roy just said is absolutely right. I agree 1,000%. This race to the bottom is a really important point. There are two practical issues, I think, and one of them actually I think does address Ed's point. One is that payers have to be able to measure value easily. And so let me just completely talk out of my rear end for a second because I don't actually know what these know the Lilly deals in diabetes very well, but if you think about diabetes, what you've got is you're looking to somehow lower HbA1c. You want to keep those levels low, and you get paid if you, well, for example, one of the deals that you've done, if a higher percentage of the people on Trulicity are below 8, than the competitive GLP-1, something like that.
Right.
The problem is that for many payers, they don't have lab values. They don't have blood values. So they can't actually directly measure HbA1c. So that becomes almost impractical until there's some guy who figures out how to get all those lab values into the hands of the payer so that they can actually monitor that agreement. So one is this practical issue. When it comes to cancer, however, the other issue is that very few pharmaceutical companies, for good reasons, have actually done head-to-head trials against the competitive products. There's always a comparator. I don't want to say that these are placebo-controlled trials, but they're not head-to-head within the same populations. So that makes it very difficult for payers for anybody to be able to say, well, okay, what should the relevant outcomes be? And I'll give you an example of something that I think is going to come back and haunt the industry, and that is in the current Keytruda versus Opdivo trials, where you see Merck creating, I think it's been called a wall of data in many different indications, but not necessarily against Opdivo, right? So how do I know that Keytruda is really better than Opdivo? I think most of the oncologists that we work with say that they're, you know, if I can be somewhat disrespectful, it's sort of Coke and Pepsi. People believe that Opdivo and Keytruda are kind of the same thing. Well, but Merck is focusing on the idea that they're different by doing all of these trials, but the trials aren't actually directly comparative. So when you ask, Ed, what can industry do to start defining in an innovative way the outcomes that Roy needs to be able to avoid that race to the bottom, one of those ways is a different approach to comparative clinical trials.
Yeah. Joy.
Yeah, no, it's these points resonate with me, but you know, one of the things I've noticed in the last year or so is this notion of value-based contracting or value-based payment or something like that migrating into the terms that you've heard on the panel, which are outcomes-based pricing, right? So a drug has a certain price, and then if a certain group of the population reaches its glycosylated hemoglobin level or not, it affects the amount of rebate that the drug company gives back to the payer. It is a distant cousin from a pharmacoeconomic model of pricing, and it's essentially been substituted for that, right? So the idea of value-based pricing in its sort of pure form is that prices travel with benefits. This is a version, and those benefits are most clear, and Roger's right that comparators are often quite poor in oncology registration trials and things like that, and even post-market trials. But The notion is that you find the appropriate prices for drugs based on the best available data about how well those drugs work, which is not payer data where they don't have lab values and they have adherence or compliance problems and things like that. It's the registration data or it's other data that's of high quality. And from there, you build to arrive at an appropriate price based on how well a drug works. Now, after a drug launches, it's totally appropriate if there's post-market trials and they show different things or different subgroups to reprice a drug, you know, and as Scott mentioned, you know, to have different prices at different indications, which is an idea we've been advocating as well and is, you know, prevalent at least in Italy. But the core idea is that it's the data that drives the price. Many of these outcomes contracts, and Roger's right, he doesn't know much about the Lilly deal. I suspect not a lot of people do. I assume it's mostly encased in proprietary agreements about how big rebates are and performance targets. That's true of most of these contracts. But most of it has an anchor price, which is still under the control of the drug company, and as I mentioned, bears little relationship to benefit. And so if you have a price that's off by threefold and you're offering a 5% rebate on the back end if things don't work that well or 10% rebate, you still have this fundamental problem that I described during my earlier remarks, which is that rising prices stripped away insurance, patients going bankrupt, and not having access. So I think we have to be careful to not allow the sort of fundamental idea that drug prices should be products of how well the drugs work slip into this sort of outcomes-based contracting stuff, which is about performance targets that we can't really evaluate and which actually don't have spillover learning opportunities for other payers because they're really sort of locked in these proprietary boxes. I don't know if I mischaracterized your guys' deal, but that is the prevalent contracting where the PCSK9s and Tresta, we can't see into any of those deals.
Right. Yeah. As I put together the topic guide for the panel, I looked at it four or five times, and I said, you know, I don't have enough issues on here. I realize we're going to be lucky to get through one, and I haven't involved the audience yet. So I see some people who might be holding microphones, and I see a question over there. So, yes, sir. Oh, I know that guy. Okay. He's not a plant, though. It's okay.
So one of the things, I guess, that I've been seeing is that we have a lot of industry groups attacking each other. So you've seen pharma put out the whole Go Boldly campaign of where they're trying to basically spend money on saying that, showing the public, like, this is, we're doing good things. Similarly, we've seen the PBMs going back and attacking pharma, as well as the healthcare insurers. What do you guys think the role of these industry groups is? Do you think it's to protect the industry, or is it to work together to solve a common goal of trying to build healthcare in the United States? And further on that point, how do you get these groups to work together with each other? Because if their goal is to help solve healthcare in the United States, there needs to be a way, or there should be a way to align incentives. At the end of the day, everyone's trying to make a buck. I get it. But there's a way to do that such that everyone makes a buck rather than taking it away from each other.
Yeah. So I take it that question was for me. All right, anybody?
No, I have to say that Akash is very young and very optimistic. Right?
Yeah, it's appreciated.
Yeah, but it's a good note.
No,
so
it's a good question. Pharma's got its new Go Boldly campaign. Pharma spends a lot of time attacking, you know, you name the, you know, entity, the other entities point fingers back. If you look at a, you know, congressional, you know, testimony, you know, any panel, you've got lots of people pointing the finger at other people. I think the role of these trade associations is to promote some of what I talked about in my opening, you know, comments, which is what is the role of drugs in healthcare or in cancer care, and the same for AHIP and the same for the Association for the PBMs, et cetera. How do you get these folks to work together? I think that you saw this work well in 2010 when the ACA was passed. the legislators basically put everyone in a room. I mean, the legislators were in a room, but all of the every single part of the healthcare ecosystem was a part of that to say, this is what's going to happen, this is where we're going. You know, and so did we all sing in three-part harmony? Probably not. But at the same time, it was a time where everybody came together for a reorganization of the healthcare system. I think we're probably heading perhaps towards that again, depending on how things go on the Hill. So, yeah, we don't spend a lot of time in the same rooms together, but there are certain areas that we work well with AHIP or with the generics industry or with the PBMs on specific areas that are of mutual interest.
Anybody else want to comment on it? Is there another question? Because I have a theme I want to pick up on here.
Yeah, I had a question on the side. One of the things that surprises me when we talk about oncology pricing, and I think I asked this question last year to this panel, but the whole idea of the ASP-based pricing, to me, is probably the number one issue because it takes away flexibility of drug companies when they have combination products to really come up with innovative pricing models just because of that one construct. Can the panel comment on... Is that part at all of the government lobbying or advocacy efforts to try to look at getting that huge roadblock out of the way?
Go ahead. Did you ask that question last year and not get an answer? So you're.
Well, I didn't.
I remember that question. I answered it last year, and I'm going to answer it completely differently this
all right,
year.
That's good.
Because we have a year has passed. So just to be clear, I don't know if everyone in here even knows what you're talking about. So if I can quickly define it, the topic is medical benefit drugs, the drugs given by doctors and in hospital outpatient departments. And the reimbursement system for them in Medicare and for many private insurers is anchored to this average sales price for a drug, which is per milligram or per unit, microgram, whatever it is. Which means, to your point, that if you take two drugs and put them in combination, you can have a price that is 1 plus 1, and if you have an efficacy that's 1.2, not 2, it's actually quite appealing from a pharmacoeconomic perspective to try and figure out a way to charge it so it adds up to 1.2. But you can't do it because you're locked into this per milligram or per unit reimbursement. And by the way, it was this, about a year ago, we had this paper about $3 billion in waste due to leftover drugs in vials being used in oncology and companies changing their packaging sizes to take advantage of that. And there was no way out of it because of the ASP system. I mean, companies could package inappropriate vials. That's within their purview. But there's no way for the government to fix it. So I would embrace. So you definitely hear from the industry, boy, we'd like to do these other things, right? Like have a way to price it as 1 plus 1 equals 1.2. But the problem with that argument is before Go Boldly, Medicare about a year ago released a proposed pilot program for paying for Part B drugs, medical benefit drugs, using the ASP formula for a different way of doing it, which would accommodate exactly that. Indication-specific pricing was one of the five things in phase two that they proposed. And pharma, I don't think, has lobbied against anything the government has tried to do, except for maybe biosimilars, in the last 5 years. The vitriol, the misinformation spread by the industry, the amount they mobilize the doctors who sort of work at their behalf to oppose this program that provided that exact opportunity makes me think that the statement by the industry that they want this to change is entirely disingenuous. The other thing that pilot did was it took away the proportional markup for docs. Right, which allows companies to essentially increase the profitability of their drugs by raising the prices of the drugs because the docs make a percentage on top of it. Mm-hmm. And so that I think they frankly value more than the ability to engage in innovative pricing models.
So it probably shouldn't surprise you. I have a little bit of a different take than Peter on the Part B demo, but also on ASP. So let me start with your question, then I want to touch back on a couple things Peter said. So as it relates to ASP, it's the average sales price, so it takes into consideration all of the discounts that are already out there in the industry, in the private market, and it has held steady or below medical inflation for the last 10 years. So as a kind of a driver of healthcare costs, ASP has just not been a driver of healthcare costs, and it's projected to stay there over the next 10 years as well. So that's the first point. The second point is what we want in ASP, yes, you're right, it is a limiting factor when it comes to pricing by indication, or a limiting factor when we're talking about combination pricing. We're looking for flexibility there, but not necessarily flexibility under rulemaking. I think that's the big thing that a lot of folks didn't understand, is when the federal government says something like, we're going to do the Part B demo, right? And we're going to do this nationwide mandatory demo where we're going to cut reimbursement to docs, which I think, by the way, would have really hurt patient access, especially in some of the rural areas. And also in phase two of it, we're going to then, we want to do indication-based pricing, or we want to do, whatever it is. And there were scant details around phase two. All right. There just were. And you can imagine that if you're a company like Lilly, who has been, like I said, we've been kicking the tires on indication-based pricing for 2 years, and we're wanting to go to the federal government. We don't want to go to them in a mandatory rulemaking, under mandatory rulemaking, to say, this is what we think that, this indication should be worth. Maybe this is what this should be worth. We want the flexibility to play ball here. And they say, okay, thanks for that. By the way, it's mandatory now, right? I mean, if I go to Dr. Beveridge in this, it's a negotiation, right? And if you go to the federal government on rulemaking, it can pretty soon turn into a nationwide mandated program like phase one was, which was, not really appealing to the industry. So until we saw a lot more detail on the demo, it was one of those things where, the devil's in the details, and indication-based pricing could be mandatory-based, pricing based from the government. It wasn't exactly appealing to us. So at any rate, ASP, though, we need some flexibility there.
Okay. I just sent a text to Jenny, and I found out that we're allowed to go over by a few minutes here. So is the panel okay with a couple more minutes?
Sure.
You guys have hard stops, so you got to run out to. Okay, good, because it's never enough time to discuss this. So I want to broaden that. By the way, did that answer your question? value. So I want to broaden the issue, because we have this debate. I think this is probably a 30,000-foot view. So I have a 30,000-foot question, and then I have a specific one where I will probably point to Roger and Peter and maybe just ask them to make a prediction or two. Not that Roy, I don't think, or Scott, you can make predictions, but I'm going to – when you see the question, you'll probably understand why. I want them
so
to
mean
make
I should leave
predictions.
You can go catch your flight.
Yeah. I want to talk on the lofty topic. It's the title. It's valuing the value of innovation. And we could have a 3-day meeting on developing both pharmacoeconomic models and their modern, extension value-based pricing models. In oncology, we clearly have a lot of weight and a lot of innovation that has to go there. And one thing we'd agree is it's not all that intuitive or simple. The question that we've been debating relates to where we – and it's really thematic, I think, for this conference. With the progress we're making against cancer, it's very often to think that with immunotherapies and the blast that we've had in immunotherapy since IPI was approved in 2011, and just the major, gold rush going on there, that – that we've broken the back of this, and the good days are ahead of us, and a lot of people like to point out that came in effect as a result of continuous innovation against this disease. So while we sat here at this meeting, and I wasn't here, but while we sat here 20 years ago at this meeting and talked about that tiny little bit of progress was connected to the progress, okay, that we're making today. It's not just that breakthrough. And we don't need to hear about Dr. Coley. We hear about Dr. Coley all the time, And I know it goes back 100 years and da-da-da. But this idea that we actually have to keep the eye on the ball of the continuous innovation. So a couple of things, and a couple of emails back and forth with our team, and I said, I'm going to be obnoxious. I don't actually see this, in cancer. And maybe because, unlike Jeff, I don't spend my full time in cancer. I see this in other diseases. I certainly saw it in cystic fibrosis, where we had drugs that were managed symptoms. They managed symptoms, but they kept patients alive because patients died of their symptoms. And they kept patients alive long enough all right, so that we could have better drugs and ultimately, albeit only for a minority of the mutations, but we have true disease-modifying drugs. But we got there incrementally through continuous innovation in the disease for the reward for companies that probably had drugs that by an objective standard, all right, were very high-priced, very, very high-priced for a drug like Pulmozyme, all right, that eliminates, and I know it's your academic area, that eliminates, you know. So we made progress there, right, incrementally. HIV, I think, is another good one. The timeline was really compressed, right? We made that really, really quick where we went from the first-generation drugs to the nukes and the combinations, and we went there very, very quickly, and we had drugs that were, frankly, weren't particularly effective and were toxic to drugs and ultimately to, you know, to heart therapy where we are today and which is state-of-the-art. And there was a reward for that innovation, for that incremental innovation all the way. Peter, when we started, I think in your opening remarks, and I took a bunch of notes, and I'll never find them right now, but, you know, it's that discussion, right? It's that we're paying much more today for, you know, for an incremental gain in, you know, in a year of life, in the broad macro model, all right? And then we hear about individuals, and we hear about cancer patients, and we hear about Scott's father, and we've heard about a lot of cancer patients here today. And we know we are moving the needle, you know, we really are. So how do we, all right, how do we as a ecosystem here, how do we preserve that? You know, pricing is clearly going to change. The buffet is going to close. I don't think anybody out here seriously doubts that, okay? And if your investment advisor is telling you that the buffet will remain open, get a new investment advisor, okay? It's not going, as Roz has pointed, it may come to orphan disease first. It may not come streaming into oncology that quickly, but it's going to come. It's not necessarily such a terrible thing. The idea is, in some cases, it may be an excellent thing. How do we make it all work? All right. I know that's an essay question, but if I can have some of your thoughts on that, that would be great. Since I get more time. No multiple choices.
Or true, false, right? Maybe. Right. So first of all, just on the orphan thing, remind everyone, there are orphan drugs, as we all think about them, if you will, enzyme replacements and things like that are very bespoke to a particular condition. And then there's the orphan drug approval path, which is for diseases with a prevalence of about 200,000 or less or something like that. 80% of drugs approved in oncology are actually technically orphan, at least for one indication. So they've become synonymous. A friend of mine said it's like the casting call at Annie, the musical, in the orphan oncology drug office. So it's but, you know, this question, you know, like if we wanted to be socially efficient, you know, we would target the major drivers of cancer incidence, mm-hmm. right? And all this other stuff around science is, you know, orders of magnitude more expensive for the incremental gains in the disease. That isn't what we've chosen to do, right? Smoking and obesity are the problems driving cancer. And Scott correctly noted that the mortality rate from cancer has fallen. It's disputable whether it's by 25% or some of that has to do with the correction that the SEER program uses, which has changed 3 times in the last 5 years. But either way, it's almost entirely driven by a reduction in smoking, right? So people will take credit for it. Of course, Sloan Kettering would be happy to take credit for all that reduction as well. But it's mostly driven by reductions in smoking-related cancers. And so just to give you perspective on this, we're going to spend about $500 million trying to get people to either stop smoking or not start smoking in the U.S., which coincidentally is the same amount of money Planned Parenthood will collect for the healthcare services this year, if you want one reference, or the amount of money Tarceva will make in the next 4 months. So those are points of reference for those efforts. So the broader question is, we are on an upward sloping spending relative to incremental progress curve in drug development. There's no question that each unit of progress is costing us substantially more than the one that came before it. That is not necessarily unsustainable, but it just means that any efficiency argument just has completely degraded and will only get worse. I want to see all this science happen, of course, but like we have to square this circle if we want to make progress on the drug side.
Anybody?
You want me to chuck
sure.
Oh,
yeah. I think, you know, again, I wanted you to discuss, but we have a limited time. So, you know, and the PACE program is a pretty complex animal, but it actually caught my eye as being something fairly interesting and, you know, Well, I don't know if you can do it on a high level.
I could do it in a minute probably. So about 2 or 3 years ago, Lilly invested in a tool called the Continuous Innovation Indicators, and where we decided, you know, if we're going to take a look at where cancer is going policy-wise, let's take a look back at the last 50 years. And so we did that. We went through thousands of pieces of evidence. We have mapped out 12 tumors, and this is all online. It's an evidence-based tool. All the footnotes and the citations are there. And the goal here is to find out how we've made progress as it relates to the fight of cancer. And one thing, and this is probably inherent to many of you, but we've kind of empirically proved it, and it's hard to do it without a slide, so I'll just explain it, was that the value of a cancer molecule grows over time. And I think you all know that ethically we have to start in later lines of therapy, but then over time, as the medicine is introduced to the market, it gets tried in different combinations, different lines of therapy, different tumor types, and the value, so to speak, of that molecule grows. And the best example of this is 5-FU. And 5-FU was approved in 1962 on response rate. And 17 years later was the first peer-reviewed journal that talked literature that talked about an improvement in overall survival. 17 years later, 1979, it started talking about overall survival. Then, over the last 40 years, we've seen 57 different publications on 5-FU. It's a bedrock of many chemotherapy regimens, many different combinations, 5 different tumor types, 30 different combination regimens. So why do I mention this? The only reason I mention this and the reason that Ed brought it up was to say we learn a lot from our successes, we learn a lot from our failures, but as we value drugs when they are introduced in terms of pricing, as we value drugs in alternative payment models, affording the opportunity to continue to see progress in the value of drugs over time. As I mentioned, 17 years between when it was introduced to when we first saw public peer-reviewed literature on overall survival. And that's not unique. Lilly's seen this with its cancer drugs. And so we've got to afford the ability to take this into account when we value innovation. So that's it.
Okay, I'm gonna ask the audience for one question and then one or two, and then I'm gonna close with that prediction question, which is really open to everybody.
So I have a question. So the title of this section is Valuing the Value of Innovation. Are we any closer to quantifying, innovation in terms of, biopharma being able to tell us a certain price or certain amount of money that went into the development of this drug that then they could use that to justify a price? I mean, this is sort of brought about by new, state, legislatures trying to get pharma to disclose R&D costs to justify price, but I haven't seen any, progress in terms of anyone wanting to attempt to quantify this.
Well, can I try to respond to that? Actually, I think that we've done it a couple of different times. If you think about the Drug Abacus project that Peter ran, that is a direct attempt to answer that question. Every RX scorecard we do is a direct attempt to answer that question. However, the issue is whether people are willing to accept those answers and to improve upon the processes that we've been approaching. I think that, frankly, ICER has been doing something similar. Maybe maybe the end product is not really easy to understand. 100-page essay. Ultimately, but that's what they've been doing. So I do think that people have been attempting to answer the question that you've asked, and it's certainly caused a whole lot of turmoil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So,
yes. To be blunt, we've actually got a project with pharma right now in which we're actually looking at the value of, in this case, MS drugs, from the patient's point of view. I think they are. Now, you could ask, do they want to now tie the price to that value is another question. My bet is no. Mm-hmm. But look, these guys, you know, we are now in the world, we have come to a point where there are enough value frameworks out there that we can start to address exactly that lady's question in a very direct and very detailed way.
Yeah, and just to add, just to be specific on your question regarding R&D, research and development costs, I think, you know, and there may be differences of opinion, but some kinds of healthcare are cost-based reimbursement, like hospitals are paid that way. But, you know, and imaging is paid that way with a mixture of fixed and amortized fixed cost and marginal cost. But I think generally innovative industries that are high risk wouldn't wish to be remunerated based on their investment. They want to have large rewards for huge successes. It's true that much of the justification for the prices is reverse engineered then to say, oh, well, you know, we spent all this on research, we have to recoup that. But I think it's like the argument around the Part B pilot, and Scott and I are going to have to disagree on even on the facts here. But you know, much like that, you know, when push comes to shove, they don't really mean that. That's just a sort of defensible position because it's hard to nail down. For what it's worth, yesterday we had an article in Health Affairs, my group, where we actually sized the premium charged to U.S. taxpayers and patients for drugs compared to European markets and estimated for the top 15 biopharma companies in the U.S. how much extra money they were making from charging high U.S. prices, and this is net of rebates and everything, and it's about 1.6 times their global R&D spending. So that just gives you an anchor point. I'm not saying that's socially optimal or not. I don't know if it's socially optimal for the U.S. to fund all research in the globe. But either way, it just gives us some reckoning that those numbers don't even add up. There's excess even after that, ignoring that and no money from any other country going to research.
Okay. So just to answer your question on value frameworks, this will be 30 seconds. So in my opinion, there needs to be better decision-making tools to help patients ascertain value at the point of care, right? So for patients to better understand all of the aspects of their care and understand the drug portion of that and including the cost, right? But also including the benefits, the risks, the cost, along with, you know, hospital, doctor, et cetera. So I think that patients are most interested in, you know, value assessment tools that provide that. I'm not so, you know, Dr. Bach and ICER are more geared towards the payer community. You know, ASCO and NCCN are more geared toward the patient, you know, at the site of care. I'm not so sure that we're there yet, and I think NCCN and ASCO would say we're not yet there, but there's a lot of work being done in this area.
So prediction time.
Sorry, Peter. So I'm going to completely disagree. I think that the notion that we should be asking sick cancer patients to discriminate between therapies based on the price to them and multidimensional aspects of risk and benefit for drugs is an unfair burden to put on somebody who also has a diagnosis. I think we should price drugs based on how well they work, and then the patient should have access to them in an affordable way. So the last thing we want, and Lilly has pemetrexed, right? So the last thing we want is a patient faced with choosing between Taxol or pemetrexed for lung cancer and saying, okay, well, here's the price and here's the benefits. So the drug should have appropriate prices, and then the doctor and the patient should be able to make the decisions based on clinical grounds. This other vector of financial burden is really distorting to the decision, and it's highly regressive. And, you know, equity is one of the cornerstones of, I think, our social contract in healthcare. And so this idea of giving patients skin in the game, we'll just help them decide if they want to spend their child's tuition for college on this chemotherapy or not, is just anathema to me.
So, Ed, I've got a response, but how long do you want us to go?
Thank you for asking. So
this could go back and forth for a while.
We're going to have to wrap. This will be we'll do this next year as a great debate. You know, I'm gonna have to try to challenge. I'm not gonna try to wrap up. It's impossible. What I'm gonna try to do is ask for a prediction. And Roy, I'm gonna, even though I told you I would let you off the hook. You said something before that was intriguing about the cardiologist being, you know, ahead. All right, you know, and And, you know, Roger talked a lot about the first shots in 2014 in the HCV wars, talked about the PCSK9s. Roger talked about rare disease. This is an oncology conference. When do you think we have that Harvoni moment or that PCSK9 moment in this field? And the reason I ask, beyond the fact that I don't want to ever have to use the metaphor of the buffet again, although, Peter, thank you very much. It was good for a couple of years, and it was great. Bruce Booth told me, I know this because I think he took it out of my talk, but, you know, there's 20 PD-1s in clinical development, 20 anti-PD-1s. When do we get to that moment? All right, it only took two HCV drugs, and as Roger pointed, one actually was probably inferior to the other. There's no evidence to believe that any of these PD-1 antibodies are going to be inferior to one another. So where are we? When is that going to happen? Anyone want to take a shot?
I was hoping you were looking.
Yeah, no, I'm looking at you, Roy, because I told you to let you
talk. I don't know when it's going to happen.
Okay. But it's going to happen.
It has to happen.
Okay.
Just look at myeloma.
Right.
I mean, I'll tell you, for the life of me, I don't understand in what order drugs should be used. I can't understand the data, and I've treated a lot of folks with myeloma. And, you know, if well-intentioned folks on the payer side can't figure it out, you know, the payer world is asking for the oncology community, like other communities, to step up and take some, and I'm not pointing the finger, but there has to be some accountability and some evaluation of quality.
Mm. Okay. Roger?
So I think that one of the key issues is when the risk-sharing contracts between providers and payers cover drugs. So right now, I don't know. I'll be a little delicate here. There's a very large academic cancer network, which is about to or has signed a fixed price deal in breast cancer, and that covers all radiation and surgery and hospitalization and so on and so forth. But of course, what it does not cover, the CFO told me, is drugs, because the prices of drugs and the use of drugs is just too crazy. When that happens, however, and doctors are specifically incentivized to, as part of their reimbursement, to choose drugs which are A, the most effective, and B, the most cost efficient, then we're going to see significant pressure on prices. Cancer has been unique in that domain.
All right. With that, I think we're pushing even our extended limit here. So I just want to thank the panelists very, very much for a really lively discussion to close the meeting. And thank you to everybody for hanging out to the end, and glad you came.